Bennett.
And I'm Jane Palmer. This is How on Earth, the show that makes you smarter. Today is Tuesday, November the 11th, 2014.
Coming up, we have novelist and computer programmer Vikram Chandra talking about the beauty of computer code and the connections between technology and art.
We begin with a look at some of the recent news in science.
As the Ebola epidemic sweeps through West Africa, scientists lack key genetic data to answer critical questions. Is the virus becoming more transmissible or more deadly, or acquiring changes that would let it evade diagnostic tests or vaccines? In September, in a How on Earth headline, we reported that researchers published 99 genomes of viruses from 78 Ebola cases. That analysis included more than half of the known cases in Sierra Leone at that time. Since then, the outbreak has exploded into an epidemic, but research groups have not sequenced any additional samples. The main issues slowing the work seem to be that getting export approval from beleaguered health ministries has been tough. And some of the research groups are too busy supporting diagnostic centers in affected countries. New sequences won't show that the virus is finding new ways to attack or spread. Instead, the goal is a clearer picture of the outbreak. A cluster of closely related viruses might point to a hotspot of transmission, while unexpectedly diverse sequences would suggest that many cases were going undetected. Sequence data would also help researchers tell whether there has been more than one animal-to-human introduction. Study was published last week in the journal Science.
Can Colorado single-handedly reverse the course of the climate crisis for this planet? Maybe not, say the organizers of the Colorado Climate Summit. But they say it is possible for Colorado to become a global leader in showing how to get the job done. The Colorado Climate Summit brings together people from all corners of the state for a two-day conference and workshops next weekend at the Getchess Wilkins Resource Center on the CU campus. The objective of the conference is to take the first steps to resolving Colorado's climate crisis by the year 2020 and reducing our footprint by half by 2025. It's a working conference where Coloradans will write the blueprint and five-year action plan to preserve our state's immense extent treasures, return resilience to our communities, and revitalize our economic health, say the organizers. There will be breakout groups to articulate solutions and a plan of action to solve our climate crisis. The takeaway for participants is the Switch 2020 contract. The Switch 2020 contract is an agreement requiring each participant to follow through on a list of action items they've established for the next 5 years. To find out how to get involved, visit climatecolorado, or one word, .org. That's climatecolorado.org.
In what may be the most risky moment of the most ambitious space mission ever launched, the Rosetta mission will attempt to deliver a lander to the surface of a comet tomorrow. The Rosetta mission has spent the last 10 years in flight to catch up with Comet 67P. The spacecraft rendezvoused with the comet in August and has spent the past couple months intensely studying the comet from distances as close as 7 kilometers from the surface to select a landing site for the small lander called Philae. If all goes well in the final hours of analysis and planning, the lander will be released late tonight around 2 a.m. Mountain Time Wednesday morning. And news of the landing, successful or not, will reach Earth by about 9 a.m. Mountain Time. The first images ever taken from the surface of the comet will be presented within an hour after landing. You can watch the event streaming live from the European Space Agency's website, rosetta.esa.int, and the NASA website, rosetta.jpl.nasa.gov.
Could monkey get up, get coffee? Could monkey go to job? Could monkey have boring meeting with boring manager Rob? Rob say, could monkey very diligent, but his output stink? Is code not functional or elegant? What do code monkey think?
You're tuned to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Jane Palmer. Think computer coding and art are worlds apart? Vikram Chandra, author of the novel Sacred Games, would have you think again. In his most recent book, Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Code, The Code of Beauty, Chandra looks deeply into the connections between technology and art, illustrating his arguments with a history of coding and a meditation on the writer's craft. Under his musings is Vikram's own story, how he finds his way to the West from India, and how he first dabbles in computer coding. His computing skills allowed him to support himself while establishing himself as a novelist. But, According to Geek Sublime, it also provided another outlet for his creative talents. Vikram's here to talk to us today about whether programming can be considered an art form, what in his opinion makes code beautiful, and the culture that surrounds computer technology. Welcome, Vikram.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. So the title of your book talks about the beauty of code. Beautiful is not an adjective that we typically apply to code. What is, in your idea, beautiful code?
Well, I think a lot of people outside of the IT industry might find this notion that code can be elegant or beautiful strange. But the thing that most programmers understand deep down in their bones is that you're not writing code really for the machine. You're writing code for all the other programmers who will come and try and understand your code in order to be able to fix it, to debug it, to add functionality to it in the future. And when I say future, I'm talking about quite long timelines. There's code running today at your bank that was probably written sometime in the 60s. So when I read a screenful of code, I need it to be clear, I need it to be very expressive, and I need it to tell me what it's trying to do. And also, I think one other thing that makes this necessary is that some code bases can get extraordinarily large. There was a 2008 distribution of Linux that comprised 200 million lines of code. So when you're dealing with something that large, the architecture itself has to reflect functionality. It has to reflect intent. So in the early 80s, Donald Knuth, who's a very famous programmer, famously formalized the notion of what he called literate programming. And he said that the programmer should think of herself as an essayist who sits down with a thesaurus. And therefore, then, programmers spend a lot of time thinking about beauty as defined by an aesthetics of functionality.
Interesting. You know, I have to say, you paint it very altruistically, and I was a coder for a long time, and I can't believe that I ever thought, how is someone else going to read this? It was a very selfish, like, let's just get the job done. So I you know, and there was almost a bit of like, if I can patch this up now, someone else can sort it out later, right, sort of thing. Right. You know, is it beauty in the eye of the beholder being really the coder? I mean, I do believe that computer coders have moved on and people really try their best to write elegant rather than patch it up code.
Right.
So in your, you know, using that same analogy, what would you say would make a piece of code ugly?
Something that uses the functionality of other pieces of code promiscuously, that somehow obfuscates its own purpose. I mean, and if you've coded, you know that you can read your own code that you wrote 3 months ago and have no idea what it's actually trying to do. And if you read large code bases, you'll often find comments inline which say things like, magic, do not touch, right? So what happens with this sort of, let's patch it up later, let's just get it working right now, especially as hundreds of programmers work on a thing over years, is that slowly it becomes incomprehensible. You can't really understand how it's working, and yet it rolls on. And the technical term in the art for this kind of project is big ball of mud, because it feels like when you go into a big ball of mud, there is no discernible structure, there's no architecture. Your listeners might think that I'm exaggerating when I say that nobody understands how it works, but there are actual hugely important programs running today at universities, at institutions, that are incomprehensible. The U.S. Pentagon, for instance, uses a payroll system that frequently makes errors in disbursement of funds and so forth. And it comprises about 6 to 7 million lines of COBOL code that was written in the late 60s. They've lost the documentation for it long ago. And I quote retired employee saying that nobody really knows how it works, so it becomes impossible to fix. So the question that people often ask is, well, why don't you just replace it? Write elegant code from the bottom up and put that in place. Well, the answer is that doing so would be enormously expensive, running into millions of dollars. And also, there's no guarantee that you won't end up with another big ball of mud. So the impulse of managers is to just leave these things running as long as they can. And when something breaks, do exactly what you're describing, which is to try and patch it up as fast as you can, which, of course, results in it being more of a big ball of mud than ever.
You don't give me much faith in the evolution of computer programming there. So you really think that if we just scrap the whole thing and we set a load of new, modern, you know, elegant, beautiful coders on this job, that they wouldn't build a better system? I mean, it was COBOL, to be sure, that it was written in. And you know, we're going to go on and talk about the fashion in computer languages in a minute. But what are your thoughts on that?
Right. Well, I think the trouble is that the tools are improving, but it's not necessary that the state of the art itself has gotten enormously better. There's often new techniques, or actually in one case, the oldest technique of computation, which is functional programming, now is being offered as a kind of antidote to all of these ills. But because you're building such hugely complex, large objects with millions of moving parts involving very large teams, there's always the tendency to spiral towards chaos. And in the commercial sort of end of the business, there is now the pressure from venture capital, right? So your boss doesn't really want you to spend the 3 days writing a really elegant little piece of code. The impulse is, let's get the website up and running, let's find the users, and we'll worry about elegance later, right? Exactly like you said. Which results, of course, in this huge amount of technical debt, and nobody really comes back and fixes the website later. It just keeps getting worse.
You're listening to How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show. I'm Jane Palmer, and we're talking with author and computer programmer Vikram Chandra about his book, Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Computer Code and the Connections Between Technology and Art. So actually, when you talk about beauty, you do tend to kind of associate that with the fashion industry. But, you know, computer coding's gone through its own fashions. And you talk about that in the book. And can you just take me through some of the 60s, the 70s, the latest fashion? Because I'm definitely behind on the latest fashion when it comes to computer code.
Well, when I first learned to code in the early 80s, late 70s and early 80s, we were doing what is called procedural programming. You break up your overall functionality into procedures and then put them together as a recipe, as it were. And then in the late 80s and early 90s, the great hope was something called object-oriented programming, which allows you to put data and functionality together in small pieces of code called objects. And the hope was that this kind of modular approach would allow you to build large objects in an elegant way.
I was in on that fashion. I was in on that fashion. That was all the rage when I was doing it, yeah.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. So you know that, you know, there were some object-oriented programming gurus who taught the object-oriented way of thinking and so forth. You know, it got quite crazy. And then, of course, what we discovered was that it did solve some problems, but then it created confusions of its own. And so there was a kind of disillusionment that set in, I would say, in the late 90s and the early part of this century. And now I think people are looking toward functional languages, and especially there's a subset of computer languages that are called the Lisp dialects, which go back all the way to the 50s. The first Lisp was written in the late 50s. And so they're very simple languages with very simple syntax and allow you to do a lot of very clever things, really. And I'm currently in the throes of infatuation with one of those. But I'm thinking that I think the problem won't go away. I don't think there's any magic bullet. I think there's just improved craftsmanship, and you hope that the powers that be allow you to do what you need to do in order to build stable pieces of code. And I think it's imperative, I should also say, because now our world is run by algorithms. And if you write a sloppy piece of code, you can not only cause somebody's computer to crash, you can actually now cause stock market disasters, you can kill people, you can send them down the wrong road. So we're living in a world where the fragility of these systems has a direct bearing on our everyday lives.
Right, scary, yes. But in your book, you talk about programming as an art form. I mean, why do you think it's an art form? I still think of it as the best programming is very much a science. You know, you're very much taking things down to a level of abstraction, making them as concise as possible, as parsimonious as possible, as logical as possible. And I think of art as exactly the opposite.
Right. Well, I think the part of the problem is that in English, the word art itself is so overloaded because we can refer to knowing how to do something really well, what the ancient Greeks would have called techne, from which we get the word technical, and technique, and technology, as art. And then also, the word art can be used to refer to the fine arts, which is what I do in the majority of my time, which is try and write literary novels. So it's not me that makes that claim. I quote other programmers, and this notion that programming is an art in the fine art sense is something that is common among programmers. And I try and question that, actually, so because it seems to me that although one can look for beauty and elegance while you're making code, code necessarily is completely denotative, as you said. You say exactly what you mean, and the minute that you introduce ambiguity into a piece of code, you're setting yourself up for disaster. You cannot mean more than one thing. And in poetry, you're actually in the opposite kind of situation, where you're trying to purposefully introduce a richness so that the language on the page suggests much more than it's actually saying. And there's an Indian philosopher, a contemporary philosopher, who says poetry speaks through its silences, through what it doesn't say. So I present the idea that some people think that coding is like art, and then I try and complicate that idea as much as I can in the book.
Yes, I think really when people take pride in something, or if they really want to do a job well, we call it an art, don't we? I hear people call all sorts of things an art, and it's really
right.
It's our way of putting our bit into what we do. Even if our bit is just simply writing parsimonious code, then I think
right.
I can understand that point of view, you know?
Right. And I should say also that, like mathematicians and physicists, the work that you do can induce pleasure, right? So that if you're a programmer and you're looking at a really well-designed piece of code, you can admire it in an aesthetic sense, right? As much as an engineer looking at a beautifully designed bridge feels something that is more than just sort of a technical, logical admiration. But I think the philosophers of aesthetics, say in the West, would have described that as a kind of agreeable feeling, right? If you eat food that agrees with you, it gives you pleasure, but that is not exactly the same feeling that you feel when you're looking at a really great painting or you're listening to a great piece of poetry. So I think what programmers are trying to do when they say programming is like art, and I've heard lots of things, programming is like gardening, programming is like shoemaking. What you're trying to do is to find analogies for this craft that is completely unique. I think it belongs certainly to to the 20th century and beyond, in that we've never had this ability to use language to tell machines what to do.
Oh, that's a wonderful
way. So we're doing something, and what we're doing is something magical. I mean, and I think we're so used to it that we don't stop and pause and think about this. If I can make myself meditate on that, it fills me with absolute wonder. I mean, it's something that as human beings we've been trying to do for centuries, right? This idea that you will say a magic spell and then something in the world will change, and now we can actually do that.
True. And, you know, you are in this unique position in the sense that you've got a foot in both camps. You are an accomplished novelist, but you have also coded. You've coded to make a living. And do you feel that same sense of satisfaction when you finally finished a chapter, that sense of satisfaction of your book?
Do you feel that when you've written a piece of code, what is the real sensation, feeling, satisfaction you get from coding beyond and above just paying your way through college?
Well, they're actually very different in the process as well. Writing code feels to me like I'm solving a series of small puzzles, which is to say that you write code in small pieces, each of which is designed to fulfill one function and nothing else. And the delightful thing about that is that once you write it, you can instantly test it, right? You can say, I wanted to do this, and then you can see if it's actually doing exactly that. And there's this wonderful moment. There are programs written specially to run your tests. And when all your tests run successfully, the series of green check marks lights up on your screen. And it's a real adrenaline rush, especially when you've done something which has been evading you for a while and it's difficult.
It's a bit like playing slot machines at Vegas, isn't it? You know, you get instant gratification. Yeah.
Right. And the thing about writing any kind of literary language is that you never quite know what you're aiming for, and you never quite know whether it's actually successful. And the way that I mean that in is that you're always groping your way towards creating this kind of multidimensional effect, so that you might have a couple of sentences that you think are, you know, they're sturdy and they're standing up now, and you think they're achieving the effect, and then you might show it. I might show something that I've written this morning to my wife, and she just sort of sits there and looks at me, and I know it's not working. But on the other hand, I could show it to a friend of mine, and they could think it's the most wonderful thing ever. So success in art is very ambiguous. It's always something that floats outside of your reach. And the reader who particularly is built to appreciate what you're trying to do in a particular piece might be born 100 years after you're dead. So in the book, I actually have a line that says something like, in poetry, there is no success or failure. Poetry just waits to manifest. So for me, writing code actually functions as a kind of relief from the ambiguity of writing fiction. It's such a rush to be able to put down a day's worth of work in the literary business, which is all ambiguity, all floating in clouds, and then return to the determinisms of code where one piece of language does exactly one thing. And I can see it doing that.
Yes, I know exactly what you mean. I think that was a wonderful way of putting it. And thank you so much, Vikram. And that was author and computer programmer Vikram Chandra talking about his book, Geek Sublime, The Beauty of Computer Code and the Connections Between Technology and Art.
That's all for this edition of How on Earth. This week's show was produced by Jane Palmer. Executive producers are Jane Palmer and Kendra Kruger.
Our theme music was written and produced by Josh Cutler. Additional music from Carson Stevens.
Visit our website at How on Earth Radio, all one word, howonearthradio.org, to find past episodes, extended interviews, and you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
Questions or comments? Call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. For How on Earth, the KGNU Science Show, I'm Jane Palmer.
And I'm Beth Bennett.